In this episode, my friend and author Barry Dyke and I discussed the public sentiment on the American Dream and his sixth and seventh book, Guaranteed Income 2. It'll likely be in two volumes. And then, of course, we never get together without discussing all the lively activities of Wall Street that may not be in your best interest. We had fun. Thank you for listening. Welcome to the Bank with Life podcast. I'm your host, James Nethery. And today I have my friend with me. He's a reoccurring guest because he's a permanent friend, right? Barry Dyke. He's an author of several books. We'll put links in the notes, but Pirates of Manhattan 1, Pirates of Manhattan 2, Guaranteed Income, The Retirement Ruse, and I think he's, I'm going to blow him up here. Okay, so he takes a little sabbatical to get away from his practice on a day-to-day basis, which his office still operates very successfully, to finish up this book. And God bless him, that book is going to turn into two volumes, and I can't wait for it to come out. So did I miss anything, Barry? And welcome to the
No, you didn't, James. And it's always good to see my good friend James from Texas. And I finished the book now. I'm waiting for a friend of mine, Tom Gober. He's going to do the forward to it, and he's doing the graphics, some of the financials and the companies. But I'm really grateful that it's somewhat roughed out. I mean, there's another. It will be out before the end of the year. But
So I might have misspoke. Yeah. What's the title of that book, Barry?
It's going to be Guaranteed Income 2. Okay, and then the second part is about private equity, how they're wolves in sheep's clothing. And how private equity's invaded the life insurance space. And
is it going to be a two volume series?
Yeah, it's two books. I mean, it's a 700 page book. Okay, and I had to bust it in two, and no one's going to read that. It's going to be the problem with the American retirement system because we're the number one economy in the world, but in terms of retirement preparedness, we're number 29 in the top 30. So, I go through the problems of, the manipulation, the constant manipulation by Wall Street and the asset management industry. So I go through that. And then I give the solution and I give I back it up with a lot of research. And then the part two is about private equity and their invasion into the life insurance space, which everyone needs to know about. And it's actually nothing new is under the sun. And I think it's say that in the Bible, nothing is new under the sun. Yeah. But I get into that and how Warren Buffett really kind of started the trend in 1967 with the purchase of National Indemnity and then Goldman Sachs and Apollo and the usual suspects, so that one, it's pretty roughed out. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of research, but I don't want to get sued. So you have to be meticulous.
Well, we're glad, and I'm not speaking for everyone, but there's a dang lot of people, including me, that are thankful and appreciative that you do the work because we wouldn't do it. Most of us would not do it. And so thank you for doing that work and the work that you have done. And you talk about documentation. I mean, your books are full of footnotes, right to the sources, right out of their own verbiage, their own words, and their own printed document, their own publications, their own releases. I mean, it's fabulous. So, I don't want to necessarily know the secret sauce, but how you find all that, my gosh, you can't just subscribe to some random service and they're feeding you all of these, disclosures. Just like I understand that there's a lot of disclosures required in the financial industry, but I'm impressed how much you document and I'm in awe or wonder how you find all the documentation.
I pray a lot. I pray a lot. It's no, the secret sauce is is to focus in an area, you know, in this, in the scrolling world where people, everyone scrolls on their phones, you know, it's just, you have to focus on this stuff and just really, you know, it's more of a factor of, I guess, maybe discipline and lifestyle or whatever, which is really important for the next generation and my belief in God. But it's not easy because it's so easy to go down the rabbit hole. But this is and you know, and I just try to focus on, you know, savings and retirement income and things like that, because you can easily get knocked off track. And no, it's just a lot of work, and it's just a lot of trial and error. And but you know, by putting God first, it seems to come out, you know. And so I'm really grateful. But it has been easy. But hey, nothing worthwhile is easy.
Right. So what are you finding lately? I know you sent an article the other day, and what you sent and I read yesterday, or heavily perused it, you know, like people read Nelson's book and like your 700 page book there, you know, that while they're scrolling on the phone, they want quick. I say they, I mean, typically, you know, we're in the fast food society. Just give me the bullet points. But I did heavily peruse this article, Americans Lose Faith, That Hard Work Lends to Economic Gains, comma, the Wall Street Journal NORC poll finds. And that was dated September 1, 2025. And the gist of it is feedback. What the perspective of the all-American individual family, their perspective on, is the American dream still alive? Is it still achievable? And they're comparing it to earlier polls. And then they're comparing that to, you know, really the market trend, you know? So, which what I mean by that, as the market's going up, historically, people are feeling really good about their financial situation. And then, and so here we're at an all-time high. This is September 2025. That sentiment is not parallel to the markets. Typically, the public sentiment of the future and their personal financial situation is pretty consistent with market movements over time. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, it's so much of it, James, as you know, it's rigged. You know, it's really in favor of those who own the assets, and those who, you know, the freedom of the press belongs to the man who owns the press, you know. And so nothing's really new.
That's well said.
So the fact of the matter is that, you know, you're down in Texas, but I'm up in New Hampshire now. I think in the town I live in, I think the median price of a home now is like $1.1 million. I mean, stupid. I mean, no one can afford this stuff. And so the fact of the matter, the things, you know, that people really want, you know, to have, you know, have a home, be able to afford a home, you know, to, you know, educate their children, have their children live much better, and have somewhat of a patient or happy retirement, is kind of crumbling. And it's very, very sad. And this is University of Chicago data. It's not me, you know, so in the Wall Street Journal. And so what you see is that the truth of the matter is, let's face it, the 90% of the stock market is owned by the top 10% of the population. This is the Federal Reserve data, okay, not me. And out of the top 10% who owns 90% of the market, the top 1%, James, owns 53%. So what we have really is a tremendous era of economic inequality, bar none. And so this is why the University of Chicago came up with the study. And people, it's very difficult to buy a home and to retire with some kind of a semblance. So I'm not making this up. And so it's a sad tale, but that's why I'm passionate about it, because one of the big things in any society, and I love this country, you know, is how we save our money, how we protect the ones we love, and how do we, you know, build a nest egg for retirement of some sort. And the thing is, it right now it is totally dominated by Wall Street and Silicon Valley, who don't give a about anybody other than themselves. So the whole thing, what I'm trying to do is bring some transparency into this this space, because they manipulate the message, and it's sad. So what you have in America today, James, really is, if you want to retire, the only two pools of people can really retire in this country today, for the most part, either the very rich, which they've always been able to be fine in this country, and or the people who are working for public unions or government employees, so they have true defined benefit pension plans. Other than that, or if you're in a legacy pension plan like a Johnson & Johnson or maybe an old IBM pension plan, most people are really up the creek without a paddle, and they're exposed to horrific risk, which is almost cataclysmic, but that's, you know, me. So that's where we're at right now.
Yeah, I recognized in high school, and that was some time ago, that the only way you're going to retire and not, you know, moderately successfully, is, in my mind, you know, was to be in business of some type. You know, I had friends, their fathers were retiring, and they're going to work at the factory, you know, and they're working, you know, 9 to 5. You start on the third shift, and you finally get enough seniority that you can get to the first shift. And then I'm watching these men retire, and their health is broken down. You know, they've spent all this time away from the family, and, you know, you get the gold watch or whatever at retirement, and you get a good pension, quote unquote. You know, it was perceived to be a good pension. But it was total reliance on the company, right, to do the pension. And so I seen in high school that, you know, it's like, yeah, no, I don't want to be a slave to the corporation, right? And then I also recognized clearly, and this was some time ago, you know, you could go to work for the government. Those are the best paid people in the country, you know, and they have the best pensions and the best retirement. And I wasn't as anti-state then as I am now, but I knew I didn't want to do that, right? And then I had my father and other people around me. They were, you know, moderately successful in the businesses that they participated in. So it is not a new thing, you know, in my humble opinion. And then if you look into, there's a lot there. If you even look at pensions, there's only, my understanding, 50, 75 at the most, 75 out of the Fortune 500 companies, they're the only ones that have a pension remaining. Most of the Fortune 500 companies don't even have a pension, right? And you're talking about the legacy pensions. You know, you mentioned some of those, Microsoft and whomever. Most of those have already offloaded their pension liability, right? And so what do you mean, James, they've offloaded their pension liability? They've had these beautiful pensions that they cannot fulfill. They can't guarantee them, right? The math doesn't work. And I know your friend Tom is going to prove that. I would suspect. I don't know that he's going to prove that. But the pensions, you know, you can't get that high rate of return, and it just, they're not successful. So these companies have gotten out of the pension business, and we've talked about it before. It's pension risk transfer. They transfer the risk, these Fortune 500 companies and large corporations, transfer the risk of the pension off to the life insurance industry. You know, so, okay, so if that's true, and it is, and then here we're all focused on the market. So if you don't have a pension where you have so many years and, years of service and age, and you've got a certain income, then that'll, you know, trigger a certain income, quote unquote, pension in retirement, right? So that was a pretty common, right? And even the pension, you know, Paul Perot, if I make another side note, Paul Perot, Nelson Nash brought into reprint a little booklet called The Pension Idea by Paul Perot. I know you remember that. And he didn't have an understanding of life insurance or, you know, But he gives you the basis of the pension. Where did the pension idea come from? Right. And it came from World War II, all these men, servicemen coming back and, oh my gosh, they needed a job because the government has scarcity, you know, mentality. And so, but how has that worked out? You know, so the big corporations, they created all these pensions. We, the consumer, the all-American, great American family buys into it. We'll go to work. We'll create this pension. We'll retire and have a great retirement. And it's not worked out that way. You know, and this poll by the University of Chicago, you know, published in the Wall Street Journal, is just pointing out what, in my humble opinion, what has been going on for a very long time, right? So if the corporations move away from providing a pension, right now that was replaced with the 401k plans. You go to work. Now you take the risk, right? You deduct from your income and put into a qualified plan. And so the risk is on you into, because now you're going into the market, right? And so, you know, how's that worked out? Well, it's worked out really well if when you retire in the peaks of the market, or you've had some fair contributions, you've disciplined, you put the money in and kept it in there for a long time, and then you retire when the markets are, you know, relatively good, right? Like I said, again, I'm repeating, we're in an all-time high right now. But then it hasn't worked out when there's great big market corrections before you retired, or right when you retired, right after you retired. And so the idea that the all-American individual family can rely solely on the market is a fallacy. It's a complete fallacy. And then
it's total.
It is total. And then you're bringing in from a whole new perspective, like pulling back the curtain on what's really going on in Wall Street, right? With all the big corporations and what they're doing and how they are taking the profits privately, but then they're sharing the risk publicly and all of the machinations in which they do that. And then you're talking about, and we've talked about several times in the past, how, you know, these, private equity groups and these big pools of money are going into the life insurance, and the only, or I don't say the only, the most stable financial product, in my little humble opinion, that's available at the you and me level, life insurance, annuities. They have guarantees, whether you like them or dislike them. I'm not, you know, trying to encourage anyone to go do something that they don't want to do. And I'm not even looking for a debate, although I will debate. It's like the very products that can provide guarantees to the you and me individual at the you and me level, you know, it's a created narrative, right? So why in the world, Barry, would all of these companies be coming into the life insurance industry? Oh, I don't know, because the life insurance industry, you know, that make the guarantees on these annuities and the life insurance products, they have to have the ability to stand up to the guarantees that they're making. They have to have capital reserves. They must have capital reserves, or they're not going to remain a legal life insurance entity, right? Yep. Can they go demutualize or get bought out all day long? So my question here, and I know that might be a lot and I should calm down and not chase rabbit trails, but here you have the private equity groups, right? And all these pools of money coming into the life insurance industry. Why in the world would they do that? Well, because they get to privatize the profits, and all the machinations and variations of the ways that they do that is exactly what you write about, proving what they do and the outcome of what they do. And then they're sharing, publicizing, you know, the risk. Right. So here again, we're taking the risk. They're making the profits. And then they're doing that in the very industry, the life insurance industry. And my question, I keep talking around it or about it. Why in the world would they do that? Because the life insurance company has the capital reserves. That's why they're doing it. And then they're going to jump in there, go offshore with all these, you know, third rate countries and operate as a legal life insurance company. And they're offshoring to get, in my humble opinion, they're offshoring to get separation from the legal requirements to you know, of legal reserve requirements and all kinds of legal requirements of the life insurance industry. And I'm saying that, and although I'm anti-state, and I am, but they can do a lot more creative finance offshore than they can in the U.S., right? And so they're going to access those capital reserves, and then in my humble opinion, in layman's terms, they're going to leverage the fire out of that because a hedge fund doesn't want to operate on 6 to 8% rate of return. They want to operate on 10, 12, and 14% rates of return, which it inherently includes, encompasses, expands the risk to the entity, right? If I'm struggling to be profitable at 6 and 8% consistently, which is what, you know, and I know I'm speaking in layman terms and generalities, but that's exactly how the life insurance companies in the U.S. operate. And then when the hedge funds come in and they have access to that capital, they leverage that capital. Just like you said, it started in the 60s, you know, and it's like by these household names and their financial gurus, they leverage it to, you know, try to earn a higher rate of return. And then ultimately what happens, you know, to all that? And sorry, but thank you for letting me ramble and rant on about that, because that's exactly the way I see it.
Yeah, and if you study history, was it Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure rhymes, or something to that effect. But yeah, if you, this is why I went through great detail of the collapse of first executive life companies, which collapsed in 1989, and then the subsequent illegal takeover of the executive life portfolio by Credit Lyonnais, which was totally illegal to do this at the time, and then Leon Black and Joshua Harris and Mark Rowan, who were the founders of Apollo Group, totally illegal transaction, and essentially it took. You know, because we were on the board of the same company, James, and I remember our friend John there used to moan about the when are they going to get out of the first executive commitments. It took 30 years to get out of that mess.
Yep.
30 years, okay?
I've talked about that.
Backed up. 30 years, man.
Yeah, 30. And so what's Barry referencing? Years. So Executive Life, A-plus company out of California, you know, got off. They wanted to be all things to all people, and they wanted to be an investment, high rates of return with life insurance. So they go drag in Michael Milken, and they're buying all these, you know, Michael Milken, the junk bond king. Who was Michael Milken selling?
I addressed me at length in the next book, yeah, because.
Oh, perfect. You know, he's selling all those junk bonds to Executive Life. Right. And so then when they do go into receivership, and I've spoke about this several times, and we converse about stuff like this all the time, Barry. Now, so it's like all these legal reserve life insurance companies, you know, they can't go bankrupt. They go into receivership by the state. And then the secondary guaranteed life insurance is through guarantee associations. Each state has one. And so they can't go bankrupt. They can only go into receivership, which is exactly what happened to Executive Life. They go into receivership, and then the state is supposed to manage them back to health. And if they can't, then they start liquidating them. And then the other legal reserve life insurance companies doing business in that state must fulfill the guarantees through the state's guarantee association. So whenever you say that it went to Credit Lyonnais, which was they took over their portfolio, which was completely illegal, and you said just a minute ago it took 30 years for this one particular life insurance company to finish paying their quote unquote share of the loss through the guarantee association because of Executive Life, while those Executive Life policyholders couldn't get to their money at the same level that if they hadn't have gone into receivership, they could have. Right. So I'm not saying people lost money. I have no knowledge. As a matter of fact, I don't think
they lost a lot of money. You know,
the policyholders,
lost a lot of money on this. And this is, you know, and I'll document in this book that actually the government actually did a great research, believe it or not. So the government actually does some really good research on this. It's horrific what happened with the collapse of Executive Life, because there was, you know, they were really big in the disability payment business. A lot of people, their disability payments got chopped in half. Some people were way over the state limits, James, $250, $300. I don't know what it is in Texas, but a lot of people had larger policies. They didn't, so they got screwed.
Yeah, it's $300,000 on the death benefit, which is what the limit is by the guarantee associations, and it's $250,000 in cash value. So, so people lost money in the death benefit.
So people lost money there, you know, so they were big in the pension transfer risk business, but the disability benefit. It's, you know, I've actually read this is a 267-page government report. In 2003, believe it or not. But so the whole thing is that we've seen this movie before. Okay.
Yes.
And the thing is that, the whole thing and the credit of takeover for first executive, it was illegal. They did it like mostly in Wall Street. They did it anyway. Yeah. Leon Black and Joshua Harris and Mark Rowan, all these guys who were elite financiers, billionaires. You know, Leon Black's the guy who, you know, gave Jeffrey Epstein $170 million for tax advice. They used all the plunder from the plunder from First Executive, and then they started crediting the private equity leverage buyout business. And then they got in bed with other pension plans in California, CalPERS and the General Motors pension plan at the time, and then they bought WMC Mortgage. But I'm getting ahead of myself, so this will be coming in the book. But and then they created one of the largest subprime mortgage backers in during the financial crisis, ended up going bankrupt in 2019. So this is the kind of shit that people in America are getting. But anyway, I've just been patient to put it together, so it's all accurate.
That reminds me of, I understand that people lost a death benefit because the limit of the guarantee association is $300,000. So their death benefits were much higher than that. The cash values are guaranteed up to $250,000 in life insurance through the guarantee associations. And I can also see, no question, that people would lose income from disability. So it's all limited. But, you know, as you were talking about that, that reminded me of the PBGC. You know, what happened with the airline industry. You know, all these pilots, they could retire and have fabulous pensions, and then all the shenanigans that went on in the airline industry, and then the PBGC, they don't have any money, right? These guarantee associations don't have any money. Oh, wait, FDIC doesn't have any money. None of them have any money. So who's really standing good for all these guarantees? And it's you and me, right? And so the life insurance companies, in my humble opinion, have money, though. That's why the hedge funds are getting into them. And I'm not talking about these jank little insurance companies that want to be like everybody else and be all things to all people and get into the, you know, financial services industry and do everything. And there's some good companies that do that, okay? But I remember when the PBGC came in and they limited, I think they capped the income, the pension income. I think it was like $4,400 or $4,500 when some of these pilots were on track to earn $8,500 a month in their pension, right? And I'm using round numbers, going off of memory. I have no documentation in front of me, but everybody has that iPhone and they love to Google, and Grok will make stuff up if it can't find the truth. But I'm close. Anyway, I digress. I don't
want to talk. So this way, I'm just kind of get ahead of ourselves. But yeah, so I go through the collapse of First Executive and how it was a seize of the forming of Apollo Global. And actually, Apollo Global actually brags about it on their website. I couldn't believe it. It said it was one of the most successful investments of all time. For them, you know, they screwed everyone else, but they made a shitload of money. But so But it was actually Leon Black, not Leon Black, but it was actually Warren Buffett who started this whole shenanigans, James, back in 1967. But anyway, so then it, what has happened, the reason I'm doing this is that there has been other shit to hit the fan. All right. Most notably, and we'll get into this, Eurobeta, which was a major life company in Italy, believe it or not, they went into receivership in 23, not making this stuff up. And then we had the collapse of Global Bankers Insurance Group, which was another private equity backed life company. And, it's horrific. I think Citizens Bank up here in the Northeast, they alone sold like 7,000-8,000 of these crappy annuities. So this is going to keep lawyers busy from days to come. So there's a lot of this stuff going on, okay, which is happening, which I've documented, okay. But the reason why I had to finish this was when I ran into my friend Tom Gober, who was just a wonderful, wonderful guy. He's and then he showed me how they're moving all the balance sheets offshore. Into Bermuda, the Cayman Islands, all that stuff. And I've been to the Caymans with you, as a matter of fact, which is a beautiful place. But so they're going offshore, they're hiding risk, they're setting up captive insurers within the country, whether it be in Arizona, Vermont, whatever. So they're hiding all this stuff. We've seen this movie before. This happened with Enron. Now you're a Texas guy, so you remember Enron?
Right,
same
up the road.
Stuff where they put all the stuff off in Isle of Man. They had these Gordian knot contraptions. So that's what happened in Enron. What was that, 2000? Then we said saw the same again in 2008. You know, offshoring with, you know, with Morgan Stanley and all these Goldman Sachs and all these Bear Stearns, everyone turning into all the stuff offshore, and nothing was really done. Nothing was really done. And so so the reason I'm putting this is because I think really the future of the next generation, particularly, you have children, I have children, we want to make it a little bit better for them. And, these guys are just greedy. And Silicon Valley is behind so much of this as well. So it's just, but it's a challenge, but there's still a lot of good things out there for people.
You know, that's kind of a... excuse me, what you write about, you're writing about the activities and the outcomes, and it's really a lesson in the it's really a history lesson in economics, on the financial economics of this country, right? Wall Street, life insurance, hedge funds, private equity groups, and all of the variations and machinations that they create. And these are some really, really creative people. And the majority of them are very, very successful. And then, of course, there's I say the majority are successful. I could be wrong on that. A lot of them, they're successful for themselves, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And so, we talk about this, you talk about this, I talk about this, and then here yet, this is what's going on. And, my whole idea, my humble little mind is to encourage people to think, see through the narrative and as thick as it is and historical as it is, to think of what's going on, so you're documenting what's gone on, what's going on, what has gone on. And then, because if, as Nelson said, if you Nelson Nash, right, he used to say, he's Barry's mentor, my mentor, God rest his soul. If you know what's going on, you'll know what to do. We're talking about what has gone on, what is going on. And then, so when you recognize some of this stuff, but yet we're both in this industry, the financial services industry, broad term, I get it. But we, our careers are heavily focused on and have been on life insurance and annuities. I know, we do assets under management as well. I get that. But even when that's done, you know, so we're talking about, and you're writing about and documenting all the shenanigans that have gone on, but yet here we are in the life insurance business, and I'm encouraging people to think and consider what can be done with life insurance. I've got a lot of clients across the country, just like you, and here that's where they're putting their money, you know, so let's just talk through that for a minute, right? So we know, or we think we know, we have an idea of what's going on, and the horrific outcomes that have and can have happened and can happen, but yet we're still, me personally, and I'm not going to speak for you, but you know, I buy life insurance, I buy annuities, you know, and so how help me make that connection, just you and I in a conversation, right?
Well, the funny thing is I realized the cross-dressing, if you will, I don't know a better way to say it, but what Wall Street professes to sell, what they do with themselves are two different things, you know? Mm-hmm. And what amazed me, and that's what kind of launched me with the first book, James, is when I discovered that the banks, even to this day, and in 17, 18 years later, after I wrote the first book, James, the mainstream media refuses to acknowledge that one of the major assets of any bank in this country, the major banks, JP Morgan, Wells Fraud, you know, Citigroup, you know, Shank of America, whatever. They're some of the biggest assets of life insurance.
Shank of America.
Even to this day, you know, yeah. God strike me dead, but it's all still true, you know. But not just that, Jane, but with why I'm coming to this book. So what I did is I started tracking the amount of large corporations in the US and the UK, and thank God for the internet. And I started tracking how many of these major corporations were transferring their retirement plan risks to life insurance companies. And all of a sudden, but IBM's doing this, General Motors is doing this, Bentley, BMW is doing this, Federal Express is doing this. I said, no one's talking about it. So that's why I put this together. Now, the whole thing is that, you know, for personal people, you know, for personal clients, you have to even be more prudent, okay, than some of these bigger clients. And that's why I think people should just be, you know, sticking with paternal mutual companies. But so all this is all true. And this is why I'm putting this stuff together. So we know that, and the reason why they're doing this is because, you know, life companies are just better at managing risk. And, but, any event, so this is all true, and people need to know about it. And so it's a deep dive, but I don't want to get sued, but so I figured just the truth is going to be the best weapon.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, and I think in addition to that, I know I'm personally, in my office, professionally, very particular on what life insurance companies
I personally
own, and what companies I encourage clients and prospective clients to own. Very particular, and this is this is really the fundamental and foundational reason. You know, there's like we go through a company selection, a process of, you know, as you're a free agent in the financial world, you can go anywhere and be contracted with any company, right? And write their products, whether it's directly or indirectly through, I mean, that's just a fact that as an independent agent is what they call it in the industry, you can go get a contract with any company that'll give you one, right? And which is what most agents do, in my humble opinion. I know I'm speaking very broadly. And then they look for, you know, certain things that they can feel good about, whatever they are, to get contracted with them. But I kind of want to drill down on this a little, because here we're talking about the shenanigans that go on in Wall Street. Yeah, you have assets under management. I have assets under management. And then we were talking about the hedge funds coming in and buying, getting into the life insurance footprint and the history that's gone on. You know, in my little humble experience, I have experienced two life insurance companies going into receivership, actually three. Two of them were A-plus rated companies. Two of them. Executive Life was an A-plus rated company. Mid-Continent Life out of Oklahoma City was an A-plus rated company, right? But here we are on a daily encouraging people to consider life insurance, putting their money, i.e. pay a premium, capitalizing, you know, a policy, a contract that they own. And so how do you make that connection? And I'm just saying, well, we scrutinize the life insurance company, very particular on the life insurance companies that we encourage our clients to consider. And so that's how, because, I mean, that's what we do. That's how I justify it in my mind, because it's critical, the company that you're paying a premium to, it's critical. The not only the financials of the company, I mean, it's ultra critical. Is a company, and I'm not indicting any company, I'm just sharing that it's like, I talk about philosophy all the time, and you know, and then these some gurus, you know, they're, ah, well, it's, what about philosophy? Here, look at the numbers. Here, look at the numbers. You know, it's like, yeah, no, the philosophy of a company matters. You know, we talked about Ohio National, you know, out of, weren't they out of Cincinnati?
Somewhere. I did. I was a general agent with them at one point.
Old mutual company, never failed to pay a dividend, but then they demutualized for the sole purpose of being purchased by, you know, private equity group out of California.
It's actually two Canadian firms, believe it or not, own that Constellation Holdings. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that entity was created to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I have that all down and then my friend Tom Gober, and essentially they took it over really for nothing, and they're like, they put like $700 million in or something like that, and they've already taken like $800 million out in dividends. It's criminal.
All the executives got paid on that when they demutualized and sold. You know, everybody got paid.
Hoffman made a shitload of money. Yeah.
Yeah, and who got paid the least was the policyholders. But and I want to make a point here, and I know you know. And to what depth and breadth, you know, that we both know or don't know. I sound like Donald Rumsfeld. What happened to the $2 trillion, you know, before the Pentagon blew up? But the life insurance industry, Ohio National tried to sell themselves many times over to existing life insurance companies, very old, very stable, very well known, household names, some of them, and that have the philosophy that you would want them to have if you were going to put money into a life insurance policy. All of these companies in America said no thank you to Ohio National because they looked at the books and seen the risk that was on the books in the future. Yeah. So
yeah, and that's what happened in the variable block, you know. And this is, you know, so there's a lot more, you know. Actually, there's another piece I'm doing too. There's more of this stuff to come, you know, which is it's sad, but it's going to happen, you know. So it's a don't want to get into it before this book is done, but there's a number of, you know, it's major publicly listed companies which are, they're not in good shape, James, and so often it involves these, I call it financial sorcery of private equity, you know, and you know it's financial sorcery. It's what are the latest Wall Street circus tricks, and how do we screw people out of their money, and so it's happening more, and you know, so. And the whole thing is that the irony of the whole thing, James, is actually, this is, we talk about who has pension and who doesn't have pension. I would say 70-80% of the money taking over these life companies through these leveraged buyouts and that type of thing comes from public pension plans.
What?
Oh, yeah. So yeah. All the money, how Wall Street is screwing everybody, they're using public pension money to screw everybody. And the things, you follow the money, And it's clear as day.
We're going to end the conversation here and pick it up in the next episode. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for joining us on the Banking with Life podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to like and subscribe and click on that little notification bell. Otherwise, join us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher for weekly content.